morning, everybody. I have been told to speak very close to the microphone. Hopefully you can hear me. I'm Lisa Palmer. I will be your moderator for today. I'm glad to see you all here. I'd just like to introduce myself a little bit. I'm a freelance journalist, and I write on business, environmental issues, and climate change. This panel is on green business and the bottom line on sustainability. And it's a topic I've been reporting on and off since 2007. I used to do a lot of writing for Fortune and Fortune Small Business. I've gone on to write for a number of other publications. I want to make sure that we use this time well and to use it to advance our knowledge of green business practices, the environment and sustainability, and take a look at what we're, you know, what the corporations are doing, what's happening in the field, where we're going with this, and maybe has this something that has been done before, you know, what's new and what's not new. I think I was asked to moderate this panel because, as often is the case with environmental journalism, it's not a single field. And there's, my teenagers call it the double bubble or the Venn diagram, where we have an overlap of our environmental interests with what business is doing. So here we're going to be talking about that overlap. I think leading global companies say that tangible and present climate change is already affecting their business risk. And so I think that overlap that we're talking about within business and the environment refers to those those logical relationships between what's happening, with the environment with respect to energy, water use, health policy, and so on. And so with, you know, climate policy isn't really going anywhere, but the U.S. corporations are reducing climate change emissions from their operations and supply chains on their own. And, let's understand a little bit why they're doing this. Stakeholders and other pressures are building. More companies are releasing their climate data and financial reports and getting some, you know, third parties to confirm these. Corporations are saying this is good business sense. So many corporations have made pledges to cut their emissions, cut their energy use, cut their water use, report on their sustainability practices. And here we have PepsiCo. I'd like to introduce Al Halverson. He's the Senior Director for Environmental Sustainability. He's worked, in this area for a number of years. And since 2004, he's been with the Frito-Lay corporate headquarters in Dallas to help with lead their environmental sustainability and compliance programs for Frito-Lay North America. When I first heard about PepsiCo's new near net zero manufacturing plant, Casa Grande in Arizona, I, like all of you, probably was wondering, well, how could this be possible? And Frito-Lay, really? This is, you know, a pretty big deal. And there wasn't much, I just wanted to use this opportunity to understand what big changes are being made at the highest levels of corporate business today. Yesterday we heard about Bon Appetit, what they're doing with the food, and we have somebody here from with their, you know, food service and sustainability. And so I just want to understand some of what these are meaning for the environment. So let's talk about Casa Grande, which is your manufacturing facility in Arizona. I think that it's halfway between Phoenix and Tucson or so. And like much of Arizona, the town has little water, a lot of sun, and has exploded in population growth. I guess my first question is to you, why make these changes to a near net zero and invest in this manufacturing facility in a town that is, has, you know, some significant water issues and, has, you know, this move towards water stewardship that is a little bit of an issue in that community. So can you talk about what you're doing there and how water plays a role?
Thank you very much, Lisa. Can everyone hear me? I'm going to try to speak loud enough so the microphone can pick me up, but also not have it interfere with the discussion. Good morning. I'm Al Halverson. As Lisa mentioned, I'm the Senior Director of Environmental Sustainability. I've been with PepsiCo for 24 years. So I started right out of school with the Frito-Lay division and have been dabbling and working in environmental sustainability pretty much since the start of my career. And specifically then on the question about the net zero and why we as a corporation made that investment and made that kind of rolled the dice on trying to take one of our plants off the grid, is through the years, we've been very, very active and aggressive at reducing the environmental footprint we have, both at Frito-Lay and PepsiCo. Back in 99, we set some very aggressive goals. We call them BHAGs from the book Jim Collins' Built to Last, big, hairy, audacious goals to reduce water use by 50% per pound of product, to reduce natural gas by 30%, and reduce electricity by 25%. And we've made some incredible progress along those lines through the last years. And then somewhere around the 2009 timeframe, we put a map up of all the technologies that we had installed throughout the United States. So whether it's photovoltaic systems at our distribution centers in California, whether it was a biomass boiler that we had at our divisions in PepsiCo, whether it was a landfill natural gas capturing program where we're using landfill gas to burn in our boiler to generate heat. And with that map, in one of our meetings, we came out and said, well, what if we took all of those technologies and landed them into one location? And we challenged ourselves and said, how far off the grids could we take a manufacturing plant? So that was where we developed and kind of entered into the net zero kind of world. And there's a lot of companies and a lot of maybe universities and a lot of buildings that are doing kind of the net zero work. But we looked at the footprint of a manufacturing plant is dramatically bigger than just the footprint of a building. And we challenged ourselves to say, how far off the grids can we get? And we included water in this story as well. So that's where we started taking an idea and a concept from that just as a thought and started putting some engineering work behind it. So my team at Frito-Lay North America really started from the engineering side. The energy engineers looked at it and said, what can we do? Where should we put this plant? Where should we retrofit? We have 40 manufacturing facilities. So, you know, we didn't choose initially PASA right away. It was more we kind of rolled the dice, or not rolled the dice, but looked at all of the availability of renewable energy sources. And we said, where's the best place to put it? And that's where we came because of the availability of the sun, because of the water stress that they're facing today and in the future. We said that's probably a great place to go and put that retrofit and retrofit the plant. So with that, we then started taking the engineering work into, you know, really financial ends of it and said, how can we go and get off the grid? How can we get off the water grid? So we installed a membrane bioreactor, which allows us to filter water, and then the low-pressure RO system that allows us to take it to the one more step. And we're able to take all of the processed water that we use, run it through the MBR, the water filtration system, and bring about 75% of that water back in to rewash and recook potatoes and rewash corn and process the products that we're making. So we're processing about 400,000 gallons of water a day, and we're bringing 300,000 gallons back. So that kind of got us close to the water grid. Then we looked at electricity, and we said we need to do solar. We understand. We've done it a lot of times. We installed a 5-megawatt photovoltaic system that generates about 10 million kilowatt hours. That generates about 50% of all the electricity we need for the facility. And then the thermal loads, the actual heat loads, are very high that we need to cook our products. And we installed a biomass boiler. And that biomass boiler produces about 80% of all the thermal energy that it needs from a renewable source. So we're getting old agricultural debris, we're getting pallet boards that have been chopped up as well. So we're kind of taking at the end of the pipe, end of the wood pipe, and we're bringing that back into our facility and using that to produce the thermal energy we need. We also, it's kind of a typical, we're working on getting off the landfill grids as well. So for about the last 9 months, we've sent zero waste to the landfill. This building is also LEED Gold EB certified. It was our first manufacturing plant that is LEED EB certified as well. So it became just a broader concept of not only net zero along energy and water and electricity, but we started looking at how can we go and really focus on reducing the environmental impact and the environmental footprint we have from one of our manufacturing plants. And our goal is not just to stop at one, because if you think of PepsiCo, you know, think of a worldwide corporation, we have opportunities throughout the whole world. And how do we use what we have done in Casa Grande as a learning opportunity for our other manufacturing facilities as well. So we're taking that information, we're taking those learnings from the photovoltaic side or the water recovery side and reapplying it to manufacturing plants throughout the world. We may never go build kind of the same kind of net zero and take all these commodities off the grid in any other location, but we can go and take those learnings and where it is needed and where there's an economic advantage as well, go in and install those technologies in those locations. So, you know, you talk about corporations. This is just maybe one example of what PepsiCo is doing in order to try to kind of align both our productivity initiatives and the impact that we have on the environment on taking one of our manufacturing plants off the grids that we have. Yeah, the financial benefits, I get this question a lot, is, you know, why isn't everybody doing this? And you know what? The financial benefits today were very, very challenging. I have to be honest with you. We haven't gone and shared all the information, but if you think about, you know, the availability or you think about the current cost structure in the United States when you look at water, when you look at electricity, when you look at natural gas, because those commodities are very, I don't want to call them cheap, but are very inexpensive for us. And, you know, you think about the value of water. What would you put on the value of water? Well, if you have plenty of it, value is nothing. It's kind of like what we're paying for today. We looked at the investment in Casa Grande as more of a long-term R&D development, an R&D project. And we said, you know what? Today in Arizona, believe it or not, there's enough water. But who knows about 5 years from now or 3 years from now or 7 or 10 years from now? And who knows where other places and other hotspots in the world, whether it's here in Texas, you know, in West Texas, or is it in India? And can we go and take the learnings that we have from this plant and reapply it? So we didn't look at it as a short-term economic return. We were able to convince the organization that through the whole years of us focusing on reducing energy and reducing the amount of water we use, we're saving about $80 million a year. And we convinced the organization to say, let's use some of that back in for this R&D to think even further out on how are we as PepsiCo going to respond to those challenges, both on an availability and also a cost challenge that we know we'll face. You know, today, natural gas is trading, you know, at a 10-year, 12-year low, so the comparison between natural gas and wood, that spark spread is not very high. But is it going to last? You know, is that natural gas abundancy going to last for years? And is that spark spread going to increase? So what about other locations that don't have that capability as well? So that's how we looked at this project. We weren't saying, you know, this is not our typical 1 to 2 to 3 year kind of simple payback type project. We said, this is an investment in the future. This is an investment in environmental sustainability that we feel at PepsiCo and Frito-Lay we need to make. And our senior leaders were very supportive of it and gave us the green light to go and do it.
I wanted to ask about your use of delivery. You talked about that, you know, since we're talking about fuel, I think that you have all of the trucks in some of your areas, and using other forms of fuel for delivery. So what, can you talk about that and how that's part of your...
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, one of the great things about working for a big corporation is you have other opportunities. So when we looked at, you know, kind of where natural gas trends were going today, our investments in our manufacturing plants are, you know, we've done that for the last 10 years. And to retrofit a boiler, we're not going to get the same returns as we had, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago when gas was at $16, $17 or $12 an MMBTU. But with a company like us, we're able to say, well, maybe natural gas is not the area to fish in today for those energy efficiencies and those productivity initiatives, but certainly diesel fuel is. So as we look at, we have at Frito-Lay alone 20,000 vehicles on the road every single day delivering our products. What can we do in order to continue that reduction on the environmental footprint and continue driving those productivity initiatives? So we are investing heavily in both electric vehicles. We're investing heavily in trying to improve the efficiencies of our fleet. So just the standard route truck or the standard truck we have on the road, the big over-the-road delivery truck as well. And then we're also making investments in CNG vehicles, compressed natural gas vehicles to deliver our products as well. So we're using it as kind of an offset to say we're no longer, and we've kind of almost run out of ideas and concepts and productivity issues in our manufacturing plant, but fleet is a very kind of fertile area, and we're going and trying to invest in high-efficiency, clean diesel vehicles and trying to take our fleet from you know, a lower MPG and almost doubling the MPG. And through the years, our goal is by 2020 is reduce the amount of fuel we use by 50% to deliver our products off of a 2008 baseline. So it's that technology that we're investing in order to use CNG vehicles, use electric vehicles, use high-efficiency kind of sprinter route trucks that we have, and taking these old vehicles off the road. So it's a great kind of, I look at it as, you know, it kind of aligns perfectly with PepsiCo's performance with purpose vision, is we're trying to always get that performance, but there's also that purpose behind it. So by getting and reducing the diesel fuel and reducing the fuel use we are, then reducing the environmental footprint that we're having on the road as well.
Looking onto our next panelist, introduced Charlene Lyrig. Charlene's with Ceres. She is the senior manager of the insurance and water programs. Charlene works with insurers and water service providers to build business models that are resilient to weather extremes, climate change, and resource depletion. That's really her area of expertise. I think that as we've learned this week, water is crucial to the economy, and almost every industry is faced with some water challenges, from agriculture, electric power industry, and the industrial manufacturing. The beverage industry and the apparel and tourism industries all rely on water to grow and sustain their business. I want to talk to you a little bit about weather extremes and resource volatility. I know volatility. These extremes and this volatility is disrupting supply chains. And can you talk a little bit about the financial risks that are creating and that these problems, these extremes are creating, and
So I would say that we are at a point now where the sort of historical pressures that were driving corporations towards sustainability, mainly kind of shareholder activism and activism by NGOs that created brand risk, still are driving some corporate efforts around sustainability. But we are kind of in this unfortunate place where climate destabilization is already playing out globally. It's already having an impact on supply chains that are global and that are touching manufacturers based in the U.S. but who are pulling in from across the globe. It's affecting basic commodity pricing. And so really today, when you look at the field of sustainability, especially in the corporate world, it can be hard to see where sustainability efforts end and where risk management begins. And I would say the two very much go hand in hand today. And you don't have to look much farther than just last year at the extent of disruptions and dislocations that touched a huge number of sectors. The Thailand floods in 2011 disrupted auto manufacturing for months. It created hundreds of millions of dollars of losses within the auto manufacturing sector. Toyota, Honda, Mitsubishi were all basically shut down a big portion of their business for months on end and lost a very significant amount of money. Because that same area in Thailand that was flooded was also a major hub for external hard drive components, it also hit that industry very hard and increased prices considerably. Now, it's not just flooding in Thailand. The drought here in Texas devastated the cotton crop here and dislocated prices by about 20%. That was the year following huge floods and droughts in Central Asia that had the same impact on cotton, and that has created ripple effects within the apparel industry as well as shareholder losses in that industry. And you know, we could keep talking on and on about the impacts to food and beverage and other places, other sectors that have been affected by extreme weather events. The challenge for many companies is that their corporate risk management didn't necessarily extend deeply into their supply chain. And so we're now seeing a huge amount of investment and innovation in companies trying to understand where exactly their exposures lie, not only for extreme weather events that might shut down facilities, but also for kind of the slow burn events like drought, like systemic water shortages that will touch their suppliers and might be doing it in ways that they can pass on to customers right now, but in the long run are going to create very significant challenges to be able to maintain a price that the market will bear. And I think that's what's bringing companies like Coca-Cola which, like PepsiCo, both companies have been doing quite a bit around water risk management globally, but has driven that company, Coca-Cola, to take a proprietary data set of water risk that they had been amassing for a decade or more and decide to make it public. Because as many companies now are realizing, yes, they need to invest in understanding their supply vulnerabilities and being able to make smarter decisions about, you know, how they create redundancies through their system and doing that in a proprietary and competitive way, but that their risk doesn't stop at the, within the four walls of their facilities. And managing that risk isn't something that they can necessarily do on their own. And I think that's why we'll see more of the sorts of investments that we just heard about happening, where it's not just about increasing efficiencies within your own facility, but also starting to overflow into watershed management. Intel is one company that's been trying to understand how they engage in watershed management in the Colorado River Basin, because they've done everything they can to maximize their water efficiency. It's no longer about their water use. It's about everybody else's water use. And I think that that is the next phase of corporate sustainability, is how they drive better decisions by actors who they cannot force to change their behavior at all, but who they rely very much upon for the continued reliability and affordability of basic commodities.
Yeah, so that, there's that pressure that they're putting onto the communities in affecting change. So I also want to talk a little bit about the pressure that maybe shareholders are putting on to corporations to manage carbon emissions, and that's moving companies to adopt, you know, energy, different energy sourcing standards, and this is also driving policy innovation. And so both here in the U.S. and abroad, so can you talk a little bit about some of those examples here? I think we had talked a little bit about eBay. So there, you know, there's some interesting things, that some examples, and you can bring up.
Sure. Yeah, I think you know, the high-tech industry is one that's very interesting, especially the industry of Silicon Valley, which kind of brands itself as a very green industry. And that has created an opportunity both for shareholders and for activist groups like Greenpeace and others to put the pressure on companies like eBay, like Google, like Amazon, to make good on their kind of brand, their green brands, by actually driving energy, not just energy efficiency, but also the carbon intensity of their energy procurement down into their supply chains. And so what it's translating into is some really interesting adaptations in energy policy that would not otherwise happen in states like Utah and Oklahoma and places where there hasn't been a really significant amount of renewable energy generation, but where it's now being driven by large companies that want to site data centers in these areas, which can be, you know, huge drivers of economic development for some of these communities, and where legislators in those states are suddenly very interested in passing legislation that enables renewable energy generation and sales, whereas they might have been apathetic about it before. And one example is eBay, which with a consortium of other brands, including Apple and Google and the rest, got the Utah legislature to pass through a bill that allowed for large buyers to specifically purchase renewable energy. And they did it because they were hearing from shareholders, hearing from activists that, you know, given the energy intensity of their business, some of you may have read the New York Times article that talked about the energy intensity of data centers. Worldwide, data centers take about the same amount of energy that could be produced by 30 nuclear power plants. It's about 30 megawatts of energy that's required by them. About a quarter to a third of that is demanded here in the United States. And a lot of that had been coming from dirty fuels, basically from coal, because that's cheap. These are hugely energy inefficient enterprises, by the way, and that was a big part of the New York Times story, so it's worth reading. But that has been creating some branding risks for a lot of these companies, which has then in turn been motivating them to either pass through that sort of legislation that allows them to procure clean energy from places where the labor is cheap, where the, you know, siting is cheap, but it allows them to do it in a low carbon way. And then other companies like Apple are actually building their own renewable energy installations near data centers and near facilities. So that's a really interesting driver, that could, you know, in the long term really transform energy generation in places, where there's huge potential for renewable energy, but not a whole lot of, kind of political will without that sort of, potential loss of jobs and economic development.
And so it's the companies are really driving.
It's, yeah, ultimately it's the companies, but it might be other actors that are pressuring them to do that.
And are you seeing partnerships? You know, sometimes I'm seeing more companies partnering with nonprofits or with an activist group on this subject. You know, how are they working together to inform policy?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's totally antagonistic. It can end up being to everyone's benefit. But, you know, that's the way that Sirius has worked with a number of companies. That's kind of the dynamic behind a lot of shareholder campaigns, where there is kind of a concerted effort by institutional investors, activist shareholders, but also a very kind of close community of NGOs and others that can help, in the development of those deals, but also the messaging, from the corporate side. And so I see it really being, very much kind of, a symbiotic relationship between all those different actors. It's not totally antagonistic, although sometimes antagonism is what actually drives, action.
I'd like to now move on to, introduce Clint Wilder. Clint is an SEJ member and has been at just about every, conference in the last,
11 years.
11 years. So thank you for that. Clint is a journalist. He has been covering the high tech and internet industries for about 17 years.
Well, before clean tech.
Clean tech, yes. And then he moved into clean tech about a decade ago, and he's primarily covering the environment and sustainability, piece. And he, is the, his latest book, he's got two books. His latest book with Ron Pernick is Clean Tech Nation. It was available for sale here. I'm not sure if it's still available.
It will be tomorrow at the book event.
So
I'm not sure about today.
But it's terrific. I've read it, and I have dog-eared my pages. And you know, I think that for him, he works at Clean Edge, and I guess for the last 10 years, he's really been had his nose to the ground in what the clean tech industry is doing. And I think as you're hearing here, that the clean tech field has an extremely important role in how companies are now doing business. And so over and above the climate and environmental concerns, there's his book really talks about there's a vibrancy and growth to corporate America that's available to them with job creation and global competitiveness. And that's really his book provides some great examples of that. I think what I want to talk with you first about is, can you talk a little bit about your position on the federal energy policy that we don't have, but could be available in the near future, or whoever knows. Sort of emphasizing the renewable sources and efficiency and what that would mean to the business and the environment.
Sure. Hello, everyone. Well, it is interesting, I think, both Al and Charlene kind of set up nicely for a couple of things I want to bring up. First is like, so what do we mean by clean tech? At Clean Edge, we've been writing about and doing research and analysis of this field for more than 10 years. We were sort of the first company started to do that, focus exclusively on clean tech. So we divide clean tech into four quadrants, if you will, and all four are playing out at Casa Grande with Frito-Lay in addressing their sustainability initiatives. It's clean energy, clean transportation. We talked about the vehicle fleets, clean green buildings and clean materials. So I mentioned it's a LEED Gold certified facility, and finally, clean water technologies, very important in Arizona, increasingly important everywhere. So that those are the four major sectors of clean tech. In some ways, they all come back to energy, which is the first one. You're talking about less energy to power transportation or different energy. With green buildings, it's so much of it is energy efficiency and the air conditioning, heating, insulated windows, et cetera, et cetera. And water is very energy intensive to, obtain, to filter, et cetera, et cetera. So, Charlene talked about, just alluded to the fact that as these corporations want to move to places like Utah and Oklahoma, want more renewable energy in those places. And that the whole thing is a job driver and an economic development driver. And that's really what our book Clean Tech Nation is about. And so what we're making the point that, you know, this is an environmental journalism conference. So, you know, it's sort of a given that most people want to do good things for the environment. The whole world is not like that. So we can make the argument that for economic reasons, global competitive reasons, clean tech is really important. We believe it's the cornerstone. These industries in clean energy, clean transportation, clean materials are the critical industries in this century for global economic competitiveness. China is doing it. Germany is doing it. UK, France, South Korea, India. We go through all this in the book. And usually with an aggressive national policy, which we in the United States do not have at this time. We have great leadership at the state and city level. Among our work at CleanEdge, we do leadership indexes where we rank the 50 states in clean energy leadership in technology, policy, and capital, capital being both financial and human and intellectual capital. So we've done that for the past 3 years. And just this coming Tuesday, we're launching our first U.S. Metro Clean Tech Leadership Index, where we rank the 50 largest metro areas in the U.S. On similar but slightly different metrics than the states. The book, we talk about that as sort of the states and cities have been the bright spot for the U.S., it lacking federal energy policy, comprehensive energy policy. We have plenty of policies. We have subsidies all over the place for both clean and, as you well know, dirty energy. And there's been this stimulus and the grants and the controversy and the bankruptcies, et cetera. But it is, I mean, everyone on all sides of the all points of the political spectrum would agree it's the federal policy is a hodgepodge. And we'd like to see something more comprehensive. And the final chapter of the book is a 7-point action plan, most of which are federal policy recommendations.
Okay. That's my next question. Yeah. It's a very good lead-in. I think that the 7-point action plan really is, it's like the 7-point action plan for repowering America, and I think that repowering has many meanings. So I'd like to ask you about one specific of those actions, and that is the number 3, the third one you mentioned. It talks about leveraging proven investment tools that we've had and we've used in the oil and gas and real estate industry or sectors. So I think one of them is particularly interesting, I think, to me, because it's something I hadn't heard about. It seems like it's a small change in the tax code, or a simple change, the master limited partnership. How is something like that possible? Or can you explain it? Mm-hmm. How is it possible to play out, and what effect do we have on?
Yeah, so this is one of our recommendations, is to open up master limited partnerships, MLPs, to clean energy projects, investing in those. These are widely used in the oil and gas industry as a financial mechanism to pool capital together to invest in new drilling rigs, etc. And it's kind of just sort of a historical accident that they were set up for those industries, and they're not open to other industries, even other energy industries. So it's actually not that, as Lisa said, not that dramatic a change, and there actually is a bill in Congress to do this. So we're already taken the first step, but of course there are a lot of bills that have been introduced in Congress, and with this Congress having passed the least legislation in, what, 40 years or something, it hasn't advanced, but, you know, hopefully next year we can actually have a Congress that does something. But anyway, so the whole idea is, you know, these are capital intensive projects, big solar farms, big wind farms. And, so the more avenues you have for investing in those, the more capital, you can see going into it. And of course, investment capital is rather frozen right now. So we need to loosen that up. And you probably heard of real estate investment trusts or REITs. And it's kind of a similar, idea of being able to pool capital and kind of one of the key things with all these things is you can, guarantee a pretty good rate of return from a wind farm or a solar facility because, the wind's going to blow and the sun is going to shine. They these things are very well researched to be sited in places where the energy resources are reliable. And so you know how much, energy it's going to generate over, 5, 10 and beyond year period. And so you get a utility to say, okay, we need that energy. And increasingly if your state has a renewable portfolio standard requiring the utility to get a certain percentage of its electricity mix from renewable sources by a target date, something we'd like to see for the whole country. That's recommendation number one in the action plan. But they, they're looking for renewable energy sources to fill these, portfolio standards or RPS as they're known mandates. So, they do a power purchase agreement. So you've got this thing in place where it's like, okay, the developer is going to generate X amount of electricity and the utility is going to buy X amount of electricity at X number of dollars. So you've got the whole revenue stream all mapped out for 15, 20 years. So then you say, okay, Mr. or Mrs. Investor, if you, put down a certain amount of money, we can show you exactly what you're going to get back. So it's, I think the renewable energy projects are good candidates for these types of investment vehicles, but right now the tax laws are such that they're just not available to them. So simple change that could have big benefits.
Well, enough of my questions. I think I'd love to hear what you all have to say. I just wanted to remind you of our protocol here. Journalists have, the SEJ members here in the audience have priority to ask questions first. I'd like you to stand up, state your question and your affiliation, and we will repeat your questions just so that it's recorded on for this session. Go ahead. So the question is about the ripple effects that corporations have on their communities in the country or the world at large.
Yeah, sure.
So, John, hopefully I'll answer your question that, on behalf of the kind of PepsiCo Fruit of Lane Corporation. How we looked at and kind of went through the evolution, and we're still on the journey of environmental sustainability for a company, is, at first we looked internal. And that's certainly you want to go and get your house in order before you kind of go external in the process. So we've had, as I mentioned earlier, just a number of great things going on, and I can go on for hours about, the wonderful things that we've done, but, ultimately then in the journey, you then start looking bigger and broader. So you start looking out into your supply chain. And as we have done work on developing LCAs on our products, one thing that has kind of hit us in the face that really should have been self-evident is the impact that agro has on a business like PepsiCo. So as we started doing LCAs on water, LCAs on carbon as well, we really looked at it and refined to say, wow, there's a huge impact that we could make if we start reaching out and reaching further into our supply chain specifically on water and carbon. And that's going to be the new focus for our for the next generation or for the next kind of evolution of our journey is our agro programs. And if you think about the commodities that we are in, you know, I tell people we are an agro company. It's the oranges from a Tropicana. It's the oats for Quaker. It's the potatoes for Frito-Lay. And you start looking at the supply chain, you look at it and say, everything is really agro-based for us, whether it's even our packaging film as well. So that's where we as a company make the evolution of going from internal focus to maybe kind of one layer out into our supply chain. And then you realize that there, you know, there's some dramatic things that we can go and make. And what we try to do in our program, whether it's our supplier outreach program or even our agro programs with our partners, is we're trying not to use the heavy hand of saying you must. We're trying to develop tools and opportunities for them to go and join us on this journey as well in order to partner with us and say, look, by reducing the amount of water you use to grow potatoes through drip irrigation, it is not only benefiting you as a farmer and it's benefiting us as PepsiCo, but it's also benefiting the broader community as well. So then we start also then taking another layer out in the concentric circle and we say, you know, what's the community? What's the impact that we have on the community? And we have initiatives where we're looking at the water impacts, we're looking at the watersheds that we are involved in. So we're not just saying, okay, we reduced our water by 12% and we're happy about that or 20%. We're saying, what's the future of that watershed going to be like? So we've done watershed analysis in kind of five, from a pilot area in five areas in the world. We've also had our business units take a more proactive approach. And in India, they looked at the amount of water they use in our operations and said, can we go find ways to save that water elsewhere in the agro operations as well? So they've defined something called kind of a positive water impact or a neutral impact on water to say, can we go and offset the amount of water we use in our operation with potential water savings, maybe in other areas that we're not actively engaged and involved in as well. So it's just the evolution of the journey where you focus internally, you then go the next step externally, and then you go even broader in the community and society. Because, you know, ultimately we believe as well is for business to succeed, society must succeed as well and be able to have the consumers there who have a quality of life, both from an economic standpoint and a, you know, an environmental standpoint in order to continue enjoying our products out there. So that's how we've evolved on the journey. Yeah, absolutely.
LCA, yeah, life cycle. I would say it depends on the company. It depends on how long they've been engaged in the practice of sustainability and what drove them into it. And it is going to be increasingly difficult to answer that question because sustainability really isn't a choice anymore. We're hitting, you know, peak water, we're hitting, you know, any sort of kind of basic economic input, we've kind of passed the peak for. So it's, you know, any company that doesn't already understand that and isn't already building it into their supply chain is going to realize it in the next decade. Now, whether or not a company decides to take an approach that has that ripple effect and benefits others or even necessarily cares whether or not that's the outcome, I think it depends on the company, and it depends to some extent also on the extent to which they're exposed to brand risk or license to operate risk. But I can tell you, you know, there are new services being provided by very mainstream companies like Jones Lang LaSalle, which has done property management for years and years, offers facilities siting services for companies that are looking at across the globe for places to put new manufacturing plants. And they are seeing ever increasing demand for services that help companies to identify places that have reliable water sources. Now, whether or not that leads to reliable water sources to the people on the ground is another question. And I think they'll be quite frank about that. That, you know, what a company wants to know is, okay, so there's, you know, there's no groundwater in Beijing anymore. How soon are other water resources going to be brought online? How sustainable are they? Now, some companies may care about the impact that that has on workers and worker health, worker safety. A company that has been becoming a lot more robust in those sorts of efforts is Levi Strauss, which is going into a whole new phase of kind of sustainability practice in their supply chain in terms of human rights, and the sort of environment in which their companies, their employees work within their manufacturing facilities, but doing it in a way that goes well beyond just the employee experience within a manufacturing facility and actually looks at human health outcomes for the employees and their families. And they're rolling that out in a number of countries, but I wouldn't say that that's the norm. And it really does depend on how long a company has been engaged in this process. But for a lot of companies today, it's still just risk management. You know, it takes a long time, I think, for a company to really, go through the journey that he was talking about and have it, you know, really start to internalize that this is about their operating environment beyond the plant and their employees beyond the plant.
Two points on this. When you think about the word sustainability, if you're in business, don't you want your company to sustain? And I think, you know, or you could be Enron. So it shouldn't be a foreign concept. You know, sustainability, it's sort of your, you know, your right, your duty to your shareholders to sustain your company. And as Charlene was saying, increasingly, you know, you need to know that you're playing a role in these, in preserving or, you know, better use of these resources that the world needs and your company needs as well. And I think a slight tangent off this, but I think the number one trend we're seeing in the clean tech industry right now in terms of, sustaining clean tech companies is getting partnerships and investments from large Fortune 500 companies in smaller clean tech companies that have advanced technologies. We talk about this in the book. The companies like Waste Management, GE has been doing it for a while. They're having to look outside the company walls, for technologies that they want to use either in their own operations or, if they're selling themselves as a sustainability company like Waste Management has started to do. And so they've invested or partnered with a number of smaller waste to energy, technologies, because their thing now is, you know, we don't just pick up the garbage. We actually take it and convert it to something useful.
The question is, legislature versus sustainability, like what issues are out there and what do you support?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of clean tech, which is, I think, what did you say, plays a starring role in sustainability, I would say, you know, you can't do sustainability without using technologies of clean tech. But we follow policy very closely. It's absolutely essential. And so there is a lot of push. You could certainly argue not enough. Because I went to a session here yesterday on money in politics, and, you know, clearly there's a lot more money on the coming from the less sustainable industries, shall we say. But I live in California as well. So we're about to implement the carbon trading AB 32. And that came about, from a lot of lobbying from the business community that to say, you know, a price on carbon is good for the economy of California. And I'm actually a member of a group called Environmental Entrepreneurs, better known as E2. And this is a coalition. It's a spinoff of NRDC. And it's a coalition of business people arguing for environmental and sustainable legislation because of the economic benefits. And they've been quite successful at the state level, and they do visit Capitol Hill two or three times a year as well. So that's just one example. I'm sure Charlene probably knows through series what else might be going on.
Yeah, I mean, I would say an interesting thing to look at is not only where is legislation arising that's specifically intended to further low carbon energy sources or other things that we who, you know, are participating in events like the Society of Environmental Journalists consider to be sustainability driven, but also where is legislation arising that is coming from constituencies who do not sign up for a sustainability agenda. That's not the word that they use, but the outcome is very similar. And we are in a place that had that very story happen and where that very story may indeed happen in the next 20 years. It was this area that led Texas to adopt a renewable energy standard, that led Texas to become the largest wind energy producer in the United States, because the farmers in the panhandle had, in addition to their farming revenue, been receiving oil and gas revenue for some time. And when many of those leases ran out, they needed to find an alternative revenue stream. And that's what led to the enabling legislation that has produced this upwelling of wind energy development here in the panhandle. If you participated in any of the water sessions in the last couple of days or in the Dust Bowl screening last night, you heard this area is likely to have to move to dry land farming within the next few decades. And there's debate about exactly how long it'll take before that happens. But the implication for the economic development trajectory of this area is profound. And you might imagine that there could be other opportunities for energy development in this area that might lead to renewable energy development, maybe beyond wind. That's not going to be a sustainability initiative. It's a necessity. And I think that's an interesting story to tell as well. And it comes from resource depletion, right? But the cast of characters, the motivations are very different.
I'd just point out that two of the biggest supporters of this renewable energy standard because of the wind in Texas are named George W. Bush and Rick Perry.
That's for a multinational corporation, it's really tough to get involved in all of the legislative efforts. I think we look at driving environmental sustainability of saying, we know it's good for the business and good for the environment, and we're going to go do it anyways. We're going to go and make those investments. We're going to make it where it makes sense. We are involved in the legislative end of it, but probably not as actively and as aggressively as we could be. But ultimately, from a business standpoint, having that vision of stable and consistent rules and regulations in the future helps us then make business decisions going forward. And we will utilize then kind of to the best of our abilities, and also the future legislation to say, this is what then the impact is going to be for us. But ultimately, we're going to go and try to do it ourselves without kind of forcing it on the backside through legislation, through regulations as well.
I'm very happy that you raised that, because we've seen that is absolutely true, and it's a source of frustration, not just at the federal level where so many perverse incentives are set up, but also at the state level. We work a lot with folks who have been trying to inform smarter water policies in the state of California, where a huge amount of ag commodities flows from, and found that it's the same old kind of water buffaloes who are always part of the conversation. It's the folks who have been wheeling and dealing water for forever, and none of them have an incentive to change anything because they're just all staking out their territory. And that's true in California. It's true in Texas. It's true anywhere you look. And until those companies that rely so heavily on that supply, and it's hard to imagine where that supply is going to come from when the main aquifer in California dries up, when the Ogallala dries up, and all this is projected to happen in the next few decades, how do you have a sustainable business plan as an agricultural company after that point? I think we may see that change. I mean, it won't be without leadership of companies. It won't be without leadership of shareholders also weighing in and trying to drive that change. But it's not necessarily always evident who the companies are who will be most impacted, right? Because the companies who might be most affected by California running out of reliable water isn't necessarily California companies. It's companies who buy from, nut growers and everybody else who's growing food there. One other challenge for us is, how does corporate finance come to bear in helping us drive down the amount of water that's demanded for ag activities? These are not high margin businesses for most farmers. They don't have the ability to just overnight switch from growing pistachios to something else. and change all the infrastructure that they've put in place. They don't have that capacity. So at what point, you know, does the world of corporate finance help to enable that transition? It has to at some point when 70 to 80% of the water that's being used is being used by ag.
The question has, what are companies doing to share their knowledge with respect to the supply chain and other kinds of efforts?
Yeah, I think the first thing that came to mind when you talk about sharing and leveraging kind of the power of the brands, whether it's PepsiCo or Unilever or this, is we are part of an active part of the sustainability pillar within the consumer goods forum. So with that, there is about 400 corporations that are involved in there with about 50 of the very, very big players, and Coke and Pepsi are at the same table as Unilever and Walmart and Tesco. And together we are trying to leverage and utilize, you know, kind of the power of the brand and the power of these companies in order to try to improve the environmental sustainability of the world. So, you know, it's a great initiative where one company as big as PepsiCo can make a pretty big change out there, but by no means is that as large as when you have, you know, the top 25 retailers and the top 25 consumer packaging good companies as well, going and working on the same initiative. So in that we are, rightfully sharing kind of some of the non-competitive sustainability issues. We are together and combined, trying to go and make improvements on that and working on things such as refrigeration standards, as deforestation. Looking at palm oil and the use of that as well in our operations. So, that would be kind of my first response to your question about, well, how are we kind of engaging the companies together? And we all have our very good stories to tell, but ultimately, when you combine those stories into one and focus one vision, you can get some pretty good results. And that's what we're hoping to see through the sustainability pillar of the Consumer Goods Forum.
Yeah. I mean, I would say extreme weather events are probably going to be the areas where it's most likely to get into that kind of risk management realm within the company. Water shortages, kind of supply chain effects, probably at this point still, from an institutional standpoint, are going to be kind of in their own little silo. So I would not by any means say that it's kind of fully integrated at this point, and a risk manager is looking at supply chain impacts beyond those that are driven by extreme weather events. But I would just say that the scale of disruptions that happened in the last couple of years, it would be hard for that not to make its way onto the radar screen of a risk manager. I mean, that was hundreds of millions of dollars for a single company that were lost. It's extreme weather. That falls pretty squarely into the purview there.
Yeah, I would support kind of Charlene's comment about, in one way, it is kind of in silos. So in the water risks that we face, the environmental sustainability are not always completely tied and integrated with our risk management team as well. But we are continuing down the path and in one way becoming our own kind of risk management team in a small sense to say, okay, what is the future going to be and what is it going to look like and what are we going to be proactively doing about it? We've gone and partnered with NGOs on looking at scenario planning for 2030 and saying, how is this going to impact PepsiCo's business? We've partnered with the Columbia Earth Institute in order to look at not only the water availability, but is there a way to predict water availability and predict through ocean temperatures and weather patterns, what the next 6 months and maybe 12 months are, and that may be a little closer in than what a risk manager will look at, but we're looking at it saying, well, how does this then affect our operations, and can we then, based on this predictive model, start changing where we grow our products and grow crops, and we're down not just to general broad areas like West Texas, but rather counties in certain areas, so India, we're doing some work as well, to really look at and say, could we actually go and forecast where we could grow potatoes and where's a better place to grow potatoes, whether it's an abundance or a lack of water, and trying to make decisions on within kind of a real time frame to say, well, let's shift more of our load into or more of our potato growing areas and efforts into a different county or a different state or a different growing region based on that. So I agree with your point about, you know, it's tough to combine the two, and we have not yet really fully, I think, cracked the code on getting the risk management team and the environmental sustainability team. But ultimately, we do focus in environmental sustainability and managing those risks, and securing our supply chain for us in environmental sustainability is kind of one of our top five objectives, is to look at it and say, you know, not only is it a society, not only is it a stakeholder, a customer, or even a productivity initiative, but it's also our supply chain, and securing the supply, mm-hmm. supply chain is kind of one of our top five kind of reasons why we're involved and engaged in environmental sustainability.
Yeah, and I would say, just to clarify, what I mean in part is that the impetus leading companies to build up their capacity around sustainability is increasingly around risk, managing risk, whether or not it's called risk management, it's managed by the risk manager. You know, that's not entirely the point, but rather that for, you know, decades, many sustainability efforts that were underway in the private sector could be seen really as kind of a brand management effort, as kind of a reporting, due diligence, you know, complying with shareholder requests, that kind of stuff. I think that's transforming, and it's transforming for reasons nobody wants to see, which is, unfortunately, you know, we're in the thick of it. The climate is changing. We have water stress rippling across the globe. You know, that is leading it to a totally different frame within the corporation.
I also wanted just to point out, last week, I had wrote a story on for the Yale Forum on business risk and how it's really not being reported. It's a really new thing. I mean, right now we're having chief risk officers that are at the executive level in companies that didn't hold that position before. And, you know, last year, for the first time, risk was on the agenda at the G20 summit in Mexico. So here are the world's, you know, most the richest countries, they're talking about this for the first time. It's really on the agenda. The story in the Yale Forum points out a couple of areas that might interest you on this topic. It kind of gives a little bit of a primer on where the stories are, who's reporting it well, who's not. I put some links to some examples there, so that'd be a good resource for you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question I had to do about clean tech scaling up and creating, you know, enough of an impact in a short time frame. We have in the book, we talk about the laws of clean tech, and the number one is clean tech can scale and is. Wind in particular, in certain places, states like South Dakota and Iowa now get 20% of their electricity from wind. If you look overseas, Germany's a great example. It was a short period granted, but, for one weekend back in May, with a particularly sunny weekend in Germany, which Germany, by the way, which is not a real sunny place, is the number one solar market in the world. And that's because of policy. So they have tons of solar, and for one weekend they got 50%. Of the nation's electricity from solar. And I think normally they get about 10%. So, and these numbers are advancing. The amount of solar, installed in the U.S. last year doubled. It's on pace to do it again this year. So it's growing very quickly. And it's, now having said that, you know, it's not an overnight thing. And the history of the energy industry is that energy transitions, this is another one of our laws, energy transitions take decades. So it's a gradual, we call it the decarbonization of energy, and this is a gradual long-term process. And it also includes the shift from coal to natural gas, which is much, much cleaner burning than coal. There are other problems with natural gas, which we all know about. So that's part of this, you know, energy future, we think, is, you know, more natural gas, as well as much, much more renewables and efficiency. Efficiency starting from connecting to the grid. You know, the grid is very inefficient, There's a lot of waste that can really improve things. You know, if you bring down overall demand, that's step one. So, you know, from a macro level. Oh, and as far as baseload, it's interesting. I went on the wind farm tour, 2 days ago, and at a Duke Energy, wind farm, about 2 hours from here, they have a pilot project for the world's largest battery. And if you will, it's actually almost 30,000 small batteries, in this. They brought us in there. They said, don't touch anything or you will die. Who knew a wind tour could be so adventurous? But, so this is an experiment to store wind energy, then that could be dispatched. So you could have base load from wind only. But right now, you know, the utilities use it. They figure out, okay, we're going to get this amount of wind in these hours. So we'll use wind and then we'll, you know, shift to more of the traditional fossil fuel for base load. And the other thing I'll say is that there is an excellent, clean, renewable baseload source, geothermal. Now, it's not available everywhere. You have to be, so it's generally through the West where it's volcanic. But that's, you know, it's been going on for years. It's clean tech, but the number one, geothermal company in the world is Chevron. It's not the first company you think of when you think clean tech. So, that's, it's often overlooked, but that's another consideration.
Yeah, I don't know if I can add much to that. You know, I just think, as the response was being made, it all comes down to kind of the economic proposition is, you know, as solar is great and all the renewable energy is great as well, but, you know, for it to really kind of gain momentum, it has to be a very viable economic proposition. And with natural gas today very low, with solar, you know, stopping at 7, 8 o'clock at night, you know, it's very tough to connect that to a business. In our plant in Arizona, we do not have any storage. We looked into, you know, what could be done, and you know, the technology is not there, and the cost and limitations of a battery that's, you know, very large, you know, is challenging. So, you know, as a business user, as a business end user, we're looking at that model and that industry and that energy provided is, you know, we run our factories 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We need that reliable source. We are by no means disconnected or off the grid from CASA. We are still connected on the electricity line to it. We didn't take that goal, or would have loved to take that step of trying to disconnect completely, but, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning, we need power to run our plants as well. So for us, this is an evolution. It was interesting. I put together a model just very quickly for myself to say, at what point does power, how expensive does power need to be? How expensive does the investment tax credits need, or how big do the investment tax credits need to be, and how low does the cost of, you know, per watt of installed solar power need to be to make it kind of an economical, and it's almost like we need to double everything. So power needs to go from 7 cents to about 15 cents. The investment tax credit needs to go from 30% up to about 50%. You know, and the cost per watt needs to go from where we are today, maybe $2.50 down to, you know, about 25 to really make it. So It's going to be a while before I think renewable energy really takes off, but it's going to be that tipping point of the environmental factors and cost factors that will really drive the investments of business like ours into those renewable energy opportunities.
I've been told to mind my watch, and I'm going to wrap it up now, but the panelists, I think, will be available for some questions after the session. I want to remind you that they'll have brownies and coffee downstairs. It's not outside the room, but it's downstairs. So if you need your caffeine and coffee fix and your sugar fix, it's down there. I also wanted to let you know that last year I did a reporting guide for journalists for the National Center for Business Journalism at Arizona State. That's your alma mater, right? And it's just a guide for reporters who are covering the sustainability beat. You Google it, you can find it, but if you want me to send you a link to some good resources for reporting on these subjects, if you have a pen, you can. I'll give you my email, and I will send that out following, you know, once I receive your request for this, and I'll be putting it up on, I think the SEJ has a blog. So my email is lisa@lisa-palmer.com. And so
and the website, or the Yale Forum website, has that risky business article I was telling you about on business risk, reporting on business risk. That's in, if you go to the homepage on that, you can follow it on it. All right. Thank you, everybody, and let's give our panelists a round of applause.